Drive Time on RT Radio 1, sponsored by Zurich. Create a brighter future for your employees with Zurich Corporate Pensions. Trust excellence. Visit zurichcorporate.ie to learn more.
Tomorrow marks 5 years since Ireland voted to repeal the Eighth Amendment, opening the way for the legal provision of abortion in this country. Well, earlier this year, an independent review recommended relaxing some of the existing restrictions, such as the 3-day wait and the 12-week limit. But the Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar, has said he'd be reluctant and uncomfortable to make major changes. And yesterday's Irish Times reported that agreement within the government on reforms might not be reached until next year. Well, Holly Kearns is leader of the Social Democrats, and she joins me now from our Dáil studio. Holly Kearns, you're very welcome to the programme. This is, of course, the Repeal the Eighth campaign. It's the campaign that propelled you into politics, and you've been making statements about this review and the changes you think are required in the Dáil and in the media. So what are they? What are the main changes you'd like to see here?
Yeah, and certainly I remember around that time when I did get involved in politics, canvassing for the repeal of the Eighth Amendment. One of the things that I heard so loudly and clearly on the doors in Cork Southwest from people was that, you know, people who needed terminations for medical reasons having to travel abroad to get that care was just the unthinkable. You know, it's the worst scenario. It's so tragic. It's such a hard time for people. And to add that into the mix is just completely unnecessary and cruel. And to think that, you know, a few years later, we have this legislation in some place now, that those people are still forced to travel to get care is just unacceptable. And, you know, we have to understand, I suppose, that at that time we didn't have this independent review. We didn't have all of the information about how the legislation would play out and affect service providers and service users. Now we have this review, and like you said, it suggests also a removal of the 3-day mandatory waiting period, which isn't
that,
based
yeah.
in absolutely. Yeah. There's no evidence base.
So in terms of the detail, because people will want to hear your position on this, you say for fatal fetal abnormalities, it should be allowed. The 3-day wait should go. What about the 12-week limit, Holly?
The 12-week limit is what is tying into the restriction of people who need terminations for medical reasons. So we know that in all instances, people tend to seek care very early on when it's a choice. And when people need terminations later on in their pregnancy, it is those very tragic cases where it's a wanted pregnancy and there's an unfortunate diagnosis. But
should there be any limit then in those situations?
See, the problem with this situation is that in any, it brings me back, like, I feel like I'm back on the doors. We're having this conversation. I don't think there was a need really for the government to open up this debate again, because what we're talking about here is an option between safe, legal abortion services or unsafe, illegal abortion services. Mm-hmm. So when people need to seek a termination and only that woman and her doctor know if that's the right thing, they will go abroad and get it. Or they could be, you know, provided with that service in their home, yeah. near their house, where they can recover and care.
I think you're right. It does bring me back as well to those debates as well, which were, for the most part, I think at that time, quite respectful and quite cogent on all sides. But the problem, I suppose, and the Taoiseach alluded to it, is he says he would be uncomfortable to make major changes given how recent the referendum was. And could I put it to you that some people may have voted to repeal the Eighth because they knew those restrictions would be in place? So what would you say to those people?
Well, the exit polls actually said very different, that 75% of people had actually made up their mind before the referendum debates even took place. And I think what we've seen, this reluctance and uncomfortableness from government, has been played out for the last while in Ireland. And I think it's a real underestimation of the electorate, because they presume that people are fearful, that they lack an understanding about facts, about science, about healthcare, about all of these things. And it's kind of, I think, a false presumption. And I remember at that time feeling utterly unrepresented, feeling that politics was cowardly. People didn't want to take a stance, trying to appease everybody and keep votes and win votes and all of this stuff. This is about women's healthcare. It's about a healthcare service that shouldn't be based on whether or not politicians feel uncomfortable or reluctant about it, we now have an independent review that was carried out with medics, with service providers, with people who access the service. And I think the general public would love if their policies were based on things like that.
But the pro-life evidence. Campaign on the other side of the debate, Holly, issued a statement today to mark the fifth anniversary as well. They say the independent review was, and I'm quoting here, entirely focused on opening the door to even more abortion rather than looking for ways to address the country's soaring abortion rate. And they point to data which suggests 17% of women who initially made an abortion appointment did not proceed with an abortion. So they would say, I assume, scrapping the mandatory 3-day wait would be a bad thing.
I think it's a really paternalistic attitude to take, to think that a woman needs 3 days to go away and think about her decision because she's not fully aware of what she wants for herself. And I think having a 3-day mandatory waiting period in place might probably prompt more people to go about seeking it and then thinking about it rather than making a decision and then going to get it, because you have to take into consideration the extra 3 days. That's a waste of GP time as well.
What about the 17% of women then who initially made the appointment but didn't proceed?
You'd have to speak to those individual people, but people are able to make up their own mind. And even if there was no 3-day mandatory waiting period, if somebody was speaking to their GP and wasn't ready to make a decision, you could be sure that they wouldn't make it. Mm-hmm. It's the presumption that people can't make up their mind for themselves. And the reality about the 3-day mandatory waiting period is that for many people, it just makes it more restrictive for people in rural areas who need to seek a termination because they're further away from a provider. In many areas, there isn't a provider. It also puts a barrier in the place of disabled people who need to seek terminations. So it disproportionately impacts on more vulnerable people in society, on people in rural areas, and ultimately isn't based in any kind of evidence or science.
And on the provision of termination in rural areas, I mean, it's been raised time and again by people who want an extensive provision of service here in this regard, that in certain regions in the country there is no service, possibly because in some cases of a practitioner exercising a conscientious objection. Would you like it to be obligatory for a person or a doctor to carry out a termination in emergency situations where no staff are available, even if that person may conscientiously object?
I think it's kind of incredible that there is a situation where medical practitioners can conscientiously object to providing a service, but I don't think it would be appropriate for somebody to be kind of going to a GP who's being forced to provide it and conscientiously objects, because that's not a nice position for the patient to be in. So I think the focus needs to be on the fact that, look, the vast majority of the population voted for safe abortion care in Ireland. The chances are the vast majority of GPs agree, but there are other reasons that prevent GPs from providing the service, and that's what I think we need to focus on. So the fact that it's still criminalised, we need to decriminalise this service, and then also, you know, sometimes it might prompt protests outside of their practice. There's things like this, mm-hmm. and I think our focus needs to be on addressing those issues. And of course, you know, like, not all of our maternity hospitals are providing the service either. So for a lot of GPs, if they don't have a hospital who will provide support services in their area, they're more wary of providing the care as well.
So
it's a holistic approach we need to take.
So in fairness, you're quite clear and frank on where you and the Soc Dems stand on the changes that you think are required to termination provision in this country. It may not happen, this change, before the next election. Would they be red lines for you in any coalition negotiation?
Yeah, and I think the reality is what we're seeing from government is it's a delay tactic. You know, like, we didn't have to open up this debate. We've got an independent review, and we could have implemented the changes that are necessary and stopped forcing women to suffer unnecessarily.
Would there be red lines?
And, like, I mean, healthcare is an absolute red line issue for us in many ways. I mean, the provision of Sláintecare care is a red line for us.
Specifically here?
I have to be honest and say I haven't thought about it, but in the moment that you're asking me, I mean, it's massively important. I can't imagine going into a programme for government.
It's a red line, is that it?
I can't imagine going into discussions for a programme for government and a party saying that they would refuse to introduce those pieces of legislation. No, absolutely not. And I think, you know, like, the reality is that it's so kind of cowardly. There's no bravery in the government of saying, you know, we saw the results of the last referendum. Let's, you know, continue on this kind of path of providing equal rights. You know, it's a real women's rights issue. It's really disappointing to see this delay tactic because ultimately they probably want to leave it to the next government. But a lot of people will suffer between now and then. A lot of people will have to travel for care. A lot of people will be forced unnecessarily to wait 3 days. That can cause a lot of knock-on things in people's lives.
Can I ask you about something else that you've spoken very passionately about in the Dáil yesterday? The mother and baby's home and the process to exhume the remains of 800 babies and the appointment yesterday of Daniel McSweeney to oversee all of that. Is that something you welcome?
It is, and I think it's very welcome, and it's long, long overdue. I think it's really important when we talk about these issues to kind of realise the gravity of it and how much suffering was caused in these institutions. And of course, back in those days, it was at a time where, of course, there was no access to abortion, there was no access to contraception, there was basically impunity for rapists. And if women were pregnant outside of wedlock, they were incarcerated. In many instances, their children taken from them, sold abroad for money. For the religious orders, they were state and church run. And it's really, I think, a huge stain and shame in our society. And it's really welcome that we're seeing finally in Tuam, there'll be the dignified reburial, the exhumation, and hopefully DNA testing.
But not in other sites like Shan Ross and Bessborough. Is that something that should happen, the exhumation there in other places?
You took the words out of my mouth. It's so welcome that it's happening in Tuam. But this is, when you zoom out and look at what the government has done, they've decided to only excavate at Tuam. And like I said, that is so welcome. Those people who have potentially loved ones that were in an old, their remains left in an old septic tank, have the absolute right to find out if that their loved ones are in there and that they would have a dignified burial. The same goes for people who have family potentially in Besbar or any other unmarked burial site around the country.
And that has been called for by families as well.
So what they did was they set up the, and you said that, like you said, the new person has been appointed, and that's very welcome as well. But imagine if you had an ambition to provide the same dignity to all the people who've been affected by these institutions, that body would be set up to examine all of those different sites. Mm-hmm. It would be like if the government tried to say at this point that they were hopeful to go on to the other sites in the future, that would be akin to them saying, we're going to set up an An Garda Síochána corner for each crime that's kind of committed. You wouldn't set up a new body every time.
And that's something you vehemently disagree with, quite frankly.
Can I'm I saying ask you loud about something and clear, else? They need to address that.
Can I ask you about the asylum accommodation controversies that have been sprouting up around the country? And it's something that you have been outspoken on in the Dáil and in the media again about how the government has handled all of this. But you yourself, Holly, have come in for criticism last week when you said there hadn't been enough consultation with the local community in Inch and County Clare, and you apologised. Remind me why you apologised.
I never actually said consultation, just to be clear. Basically, I think what we've seen from the far right kind of movement is that there's kind of dog whistles, and maybe for any of your listeners, that's saying a sentence that sounds reasonable but actually has an impact that gives people a kind of liberty to object to, for example, asylum seekers coming into their area. So saying that there should be consultation might insinuate.
You said engagement.
I said engagement.
Mm. So why did you apologise?
I'm just explaining that, yeah. So to say that communities should be consulted with might insinuate that they could be then vetoing people coming into their area. Like I said, I never said consultation. Mm-hmm. But when I explained my comments, it was to say we have a responsibility to choose our word carefully in times like this because there is those kind of dog whistles.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've seen this in my...
I really apologise. I still don't know why you apologise, because you're saying you didn't say consult, you said engage with the community. Do you stand by that government should engage with communities before asylum centres are open?
Yeah, but I apologise for making it sound like I was kind of feeding into that narrative. It was one clip out of a longer contribution. I said, I think community should be engaged with, and people kind of took it up that I was saying there needs to be a consultation with something the far right were saying. So I needed to clarify that's not what I meant, because what is happening, and I think a lot of your TDs would tell you this around the country, is because there's nothing in place, when a group of people are coming into the area, people hear it through the newspaper or a local media source or word of mouth. And there's this like absence of any kind of information. And it's not that people actually, you know, should have a kind of a consultation. Are you okay with this or not? Not at all. People can move into an area in any day of the week at any time, you know, whether there's a war or not, and there's not a consultation with the community. But when there's no information or engagement, what happens is there's loads of misinformation goes around. There's this void created. People start talking about it, and then it gives this, that void is being filled by people saying things that are potentially not true.
Yeah, and the government are saying
hate.
They're working on a new communication strategy and so on. But the people in Inch, in Clare, to use that example, and that's where you got into a little bit of trouble on, they were saying, a lot of them, that there was a lack of infrastructure or public services. Is that ever, in your opinion, a valid argument to reject an asylum accommodation centre?
No, like, the thing is, and, you know, I have it, we all have it in our own communities, like, you know, and I was trying to explain this in my own community recently. Mm-hmm. Of course, we would love to be able to providing the best facilities possible. And look, it's a real shame that we're so far into this and there still isn't a proper strategy to provide more suitable accommodation. I'll continue to push the government to do that.
So you're saying,
but
to
in
all
the
rural
meantime,
communities,
it's
never, if you're waiting, if you have long waiting times for your GP and there needs to be, under international legal obligations, we need to accommodate asylum seekers, international protection applicants. It's something we have to put up with. That is the message, isn't it?
Yeah, because, I mean, basically, it's either people go into unsuitable accommodation or they go on the street. And we saw what's happening to the street. It's being set out, people's tents being set alight. And look, it's an absolutely desperate situation. I'll continue to push for the government to come up with a strategy. We're so far into this, it's a disgrace that we haven't. But we have to flip this and imagine if you and I, if your listeners, had to flee this country because there was bombs being indiscriminately dropped on us. We're going to other countries trying to seek shelter, refuge, space. I mean, somewhere is better than the street, and we have to be really humane about this. We have to be realistic about it. There is a legal and a moral obligation on us to do this. And as a country of emigrants, I mean, we all know somebody who's made those journeys abroad different times, ancestors still abroad. We should understand better than anyone how it can feel to be rejected in a community, to not be welcomed. And I really hope that we continue to do ourselves proud. And I want to commend the communities who have welcomed asylum seekers into their area, who've set up welcoming committees, who are doing all the things that they can. And look,
and
there's so much coming back
family,
into the communities.
Holly, after the break, about how good it can be as well in terms
in
of
many
of
instances, saving rural schools from closing down with numbers. We need more people in our GA teams, all of these things. It's not about benefiting from war, but it's about seeing the positives that can come from it and the new people coming into our communities.
We'll speak again. Thank you very much indeed for joining us on the programme. Leader of the Social Democrats, Holly Kearns, thank you.